The Strategic Air Command hoped to replace it eventually with the Mark 28, a boosted weapon. The Mark 28 was 8 to 12 feet long, depending on its configuration, and weighed just 2,000 pounds. It was small enough and light enough to be delivered by a fighter plane, and a single B-52 could carry at least four of them. The military advantages of boosted weapons were obvious, but the revolutionary new design raised a number of safety concerns. The nuclear core of a boosted weapon wouldn't be stored separately. It would be sealed inside the weapon, like the pit within a plum. Boosted, sealed pit weapons would be stored fully assembled, their cores already surrounded by high explosives, their thermal batteries ready to ignite. In many respects, they'd be wooden bombs, and that is what could make them, potentially, so dangerous during an accident. The first sealed pit weapon scheduled to enter the stockpile was the Genie, a rocket designed for air defense. Conventional anti-aircraft weapons seemed inadequate for destroying hundreds of Soviet bombers during a thermonuclear attack. Failing to shoot down a single plane could mean losing an American city. The Air Force believed that detonating atomic warheads in the skies above the United States and Canada would offer the best hope of success. And that view was endorsed in March 1955 by James R. Killian, the president of MIT, who headed a top-secret panel on the threat of surprise attack. At the height of American fears about a bomber gap, atomic anti-aircraft weapons promised to counter the Soviet Union's numerical advantage in long-range bombers, much the same way tactical nuclear weapons were supposed to compensate for the Red Army's greater troop strength in Europe. The Genie would be carried by Air Force fighter interceptors. It had a small 1.5-kiloton warhead and a solid-fueled rocket engine. Unlike conventional air defense weapons, it didn't need a direct hit to eliminate a target, and it could prove equally useful against a single Soviet bomber or a large formation of them. Once the enemy was spotted, the fire control system of the American fighter plane would calculate the distance to the attacker and set the timer of the Genie's warhead. The fighter pilot would launch the Genie. Its rocket motor would burn for about 2 seconds, and the weapon would shoot toward the target at about 3 times the speed of sound. The Genie's nuclear warhead would detonate when the timer ran out. The ensuing fireball would destroy any aircraft within about 100 yards, and the blast wave would cause severe damage at an even greater distance. But the burst of radiation released by the explosion would pose the most deadly threat to Soviet air crews. The Genie could miss its target badly and still prove effective. It had a lethal envelope with a radius of about 1 mile, and the probability of kill, PK, within that envelope was likely to be 92%. The Soviet air crew's death from radiation might take as long as 5 minutes, a delay that made it even more important to fire the Genie as far as possible from urban areas. Detonated at a high altitude, the weapon produced little fallout and didn't lift any debris from the ground to form a mushroom cloud. After the bright white flash, a circular cloud drifted from the point of detonation, forming an immense smoke ring in the sky. The Air Force wanted the Genie to be deployed by January 1, 1957, but first the Atomic Energy Commission had to determine whether the weapon was safe. Thousands of Genies would be stored at American airfields. Moreover, thousands of Nike missiles, as well as hundreds of Bomarks armed with small nuclear warheads, would soon be deployed in and around dozens of American cities. All of these weapons had been designed to explode in the skies above North America. Their detonation on the ground would be catastrophic. The Department of Defense has a most urgent need for information pertaining to the safety of nuclear weapons, an AEC official wrote in a top-secret memo as the Genie's deployment date approached. In the decade or so since the first atomic bomb was dropped, the subject of nuclear weapons safety had received little attention. The bombs had always been stored and transported without their nuclear cores. What would a fuel fire, a high-speed collision, or shrapnel from a nearby explosion do to a sealed pit weapon? The AEC hurriedly began a series of tests to find out. Project 56 was the code name for an AEC safety investigation of sealed pit weapons secretly conducted in a remote valley at the Nevada test site. Computers still lacked the processing power to simulate the behavior of a nuclear weapon during an accident, and so actual devices had to be used. Under normal conditions, a sealed pit weapon would fully detonate when all the explosive lenses surrounding its core went off at once, causing a symmetrical implosion. The AEC's greatest concern was that an imperfect asymmetrical implosion, caused, for example, by a bullet setting off some of the high explosives, could produce a nuclear yield. The Project 56 tests focused on what would happen if one of the explosive lenses were set off at a single point. It was thought almost impossible for more than one bullet or more than one piece of shrapnel to strike a weapon at different points simultaneously during an accident. The velocity of these high explosives was so fast that a lens would go off within microseconds of being struck, allowing no time for something else to hit. If the weapon's high explosives went off at a single point, the nuclear core might simply blow to pieces without producing any yield. That's what the scientists of Project 56 hoped to observe. Weapons that were one point safe. But the core might also implode just enough to cause a nuclear detonation. Between November 1955 and January 1956, the nuclear components of four weapon designs underwent safety tests in the Nevada desert. Each device was placed inside a small wooden building, and then a single detonator was set off. Three of the designs passed the test. A one-point detonation didn't produce any yield. The fourth design failed the test, surprising everyone with a substantial detonation. The Genie's warhead was among those pronounced one-point safe. But Project 56 revealed that a nuclear detonation wasn't the only danger that a weapon accident might pose. The core of the Genie contained plutonium, and when it blew apart, plutonium dust spread through the air. The risks of plutonium exposure were becoming more apparent in the mid-1950s. Although the alpha particles emitted by plutonium are too weak to penetrate human skin, they can destroy lung tissue when plutonium dust is inhaled. Anyone within a few hundred feet of a weapon accident spreading plutonium can inhale a swiftly lethal dose. Cancers of the lung, liver, lymph nodes, and bone can be caused by the inhalation of minute amounts. And the fallout from such an accident may contaminate a large area for a long time. Plutonium has a half-life of about 24,000 years. It remains hazardous throughout that period, and plutonium dust is hard to clean up. The problem of decontaminating the site of an accident may be insurmountable, a classified Los Alamos report noted a month after the Genie's one-point safety test, and it may have to be written off permanently. The AEC debated whether to remove plutonium from the Genie's core and use highly enriched uranium instead. In one respect, uranium-235 seemed to be safer. It has a half-life of about 700 million years, but emits radiation at a much lower rate than plutonium, greatly reducing the inhalation hazard. And yet a Genie with a uranium core had its own risks. Norris Bradbury, the director of Los Alamos, warned the AEC that such a core was probably not safe against one-point detonation. Given the choice between an accident that might cause a nuclear explosion and one that might send a cloud of plutonium over an American city, the Air Force preferred the latter. Handmade emergency capability Genies were rushed into production with cores that contained plutonium. Once Soviet bombers were within range, air defense weapons like the Genie had to be fired immediately. Any delay in authorizing their use could allow some planes to reach their targets. Toward the end of 1955, the Joint Chiefs of Staff sought permission to use atomic air defense weapons without having to ask the president. They argued that if such authority were pre-delegated, the military could respond instantly to an attack. Secretary of Defense Wilson backed the Joint Chiefs, arguing that it was critical for the Air Force to have some sort of advance authorization. Harry Truman had insisted repeatedly that the President of the United States should be the only person allowed to order the use of a nuclear weapon. But the nature of the Soviet threat had changed, and President Eisenhower had more faith in the discipline of the American military. In April 1956, Eisenhower signed a pre-delegation order that authorized the use of atomic weapons for air defense within the United States and along its borders. The order took effect the following December after rules of engagement were approved by the Secretary of Defense. Those rules allowed American planes to fire Genies at any Soviet aircraft that appeared hostile. Air Force commanders were granted wide latitude to decide when these nuclear weapons could be used. But the Joint Chiefs demanded strict command control of forces engaged in air defense. The Genies had to be kept locked away in storage igloos, never to be flown over the United States until the nation was under attack. For years, the Department of Defense had refused to discuss where America's nuclear weapons were deployed. "We will neither confirm nor deny," was the standard response whenever a journalist asked if atomic or hydrogen bombs were kept at a specific location. The policy was justified by the need for military secrecy, and yet the desire to avoid controversy and maintain good public relations was just as important. When atomic bombs were first transferred to SAC bases in French Morocco, the French government wasn't told about the weapons. But the deployment of Genies at air bases throughout the United States was announced in an Air Force press release. According to a secret Pentagon memo, publicity that stressed the safety and effectiveness of the new weapon should have a positive effect on national morale, and information about the Genies' lethal radius might be discouraging for Soviet air crews. The possibility of any nuclear explosion occurring as a result of an accident involving either impact or fire is virtually non-existent, Secretary of Defense Wilson assured the public. His press release about the Genie didn't mention the risk of plutonium contamination. It did note, however, that someone standing on the ground directly beneath the high-altitude detonation of a Genie would be exposed to less radiation than a hundredth of a dose received in a standard medical X-ray. To prove the point, a Genie was set off 18,000 feet above the heads of five Air Force officers and a photographer at the Nevada test site. The officers wore summer uniforms and no protective gear. A photograph, taken at the moment of detonation, shows that two of the men instinctively ducked, two shielded their eyes, and one stared upward, looking straight at the blast. "It glowed for an instant like a newborn sun," Time magazine reported, "then faded into a rosy, donut-shaped cloud." In January 1957, the Secretary of the Air Force, Donald A. Quarles, visited Sandia to attend briefings on the latest sealed pit weapons. Quarles left the meetings worried about the safety of the Genie, and he was unusually qualified to pass judgment. He'd served for 2 years as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Development, helping to select new weapon systems, guiding the Pentagon's investment in new technologies, and contemplating the future of warfare. He'd also spent a year as president of Sandia, immersed in the minutiae of atomic bombs. Small, wiry, brilliant, and intense, a high school graduate at the age of 15 who later studied math and physics at Yale, Quarles felt the weight of his job, his place at the very epicenter of the arms race. He rarely took vacations and could often be found at his Pentagon office late into the night, 6 or 7 days a week. Only a handful of people understood, as well as Quarles did, how America's nuclear weapons worked and how the military planned to use them. Within weeks of the briefings for Quarles at Sandia, the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project created a safety board to scrutinize the design of every sealed pit weapon in development. The Air Force soon commissioned wide-ranging studies of whether a nuclear weapon could be detonated by accident. And in July 1957, Quarles asked the Atomic Energy Commission to conduct the nation's first comprehensive inquiry into the possibilities for increasing the safety of nuclear weapons. The AEC agreed to do it, and a team of Sandia engineers was given the lead role. One of the inquiry's first tasks was to compile a list of the accidents that had already occurred with nuclear weapons. The list would be useful for predicting not only what might happen to the new sealed pit designs in the field, but also the frequency of mishaps. The Department of Defense didn't always notify the AEC about nuclear weapon accidents, and a thorough accounting of them proved difficult to obtain. The Air Force eventually submitted a list of 87 accidents and incidents that had occurred between 1950 and the end of 1957. Sandia found an additional 7 that the Air Force had somehow neglected to include. Neither the Army nor the Navy submitted a list. They'd failed to keep track of their nuclear accidents. More than one-third of those on the Air Force list involved war reserve, atomic, or hydrogen bombs, weapons that could be used in battle. The rest involved training weapons, and all of the accidents shed light on the many unforeseeable ways that things could go wrong. An accident might be caused by a mechanical problem. On February 13, 1950, a B-36 bomber took off from Eielson Air Force Base, about 30 miles south of Fairbanks, Alaska. The crew was on a training mission, learning how to operate from a forward base near the Arctic. The weather at Eielson was windy and snowy, and the ground temperature had risen in the previous few hours. It was about minus 27 degrees Fahrenheit. Captain Harold L. Berry and 16 crew members had been fully briefed on the mission. Fly to Montana, turn around, go to Southern California, turn again, head north to San Francisco, simulate the release of a Mark IV atomic bomb above the city, and then land at a SAC base in Fort Worth, Texas. The mission would take about 20 hours. In the middle of the night, as the B-36 reached an altitude of 15,000 feet, it started to lose power. Ice had accumulated on the engines, as well as on the wings and propellers. The crew couldn't see the ice. Visibility was poor due to the darkness, cloud cover, and frost on the windows. But they could hear chunks of ice hitting the plane. It sounded like a hailstorm. Ice clogged the carburetors, 3 of the 6 engines caught fire, and the bomber rapidly lost altitude. Captain Berry managed to guide the plane over the ocean not far from Princess Royal Island in British Columbia, Canada. He ordered a co-pilot to open the bomb bay doors and dump the Mark IV. The doors were stuck and wouldn't open. The co-pilot tried again. The doors opened, and the Mark IV fell from the plane. Its high explosives detonated 3,000 feet above the water, and a bright flash lit the night sky. The bomb did not contain a nuclear core. Navigating solely by radar, Captain Berry steered the plane back toward land and ordered the crew to bail out. One of the co-pilots, Captain Theodore Schreier, mistakenly put on a life jacket over his parachute. He was never seen again. The first 4 men to jump from the plane also vanished, perhaps carried by the wind into the ocean. Captain Berry, the last to go, parachuted safely onto a frozen lake, hiked for miles through deep snow to the coast, and survived, along with the rest of his crew. The abandoned B-36 somehow flew another 200 miles before crashing on Vancouver Island. An accident could occur during the loading, unloading, or movement of weapons. On at least 4 occasions, the bridge wire detonators of Mark VI atomic bombs fired when the weapons were improperly removed from aircraft. They were training weapons, and nobody got hurt. But with the new sealed pit weapons, that sort of mistake would cause a full-scale nuclear detonation. At least 6 times, the carts used to carry Mark VI bombs broke away from the vehicles towing them. During one incident, the cart rolled into a ditch. Had it rolled in another direction, a classified report noted, a live MK6 weapon would have plunged over a steep embankment. Dropping a nuclear weapon was never a good idea. Impact tests revealed that when the Genie was armed, it didn't need a firing signal to detonate. The Genie could produce a nuclear explosion just by hitting the ground. an accident could be made worse by the response. In the early days of the Korean War, amid fears that Japan and Taiwan might be attacked, a B-29 bomber prepared to take off from Fairfield Suisun Air Force Base in California. It was 10 o'clock at night. The mission was considered urgent, its cargo top secret. One of the 9 Mark IV atomic bombs being transferred to Guam at President Truman's request. The cores would be airlifted separately. Brigadier General Robert F. Travis sat in the cockpit as a high-level escort for the weapon. Travis had displayed great courage during the Second World War, leading 35 bombing missions for the 8th Air Force. As the B-29 gained speed, one of its engines failed near the end of the runway. The bomber lifted off the ground, and then a second engine failed. The pilot, Captain Eugene Steffes, tried to retract the landing gear and reduce drag, but the wheels were stuck, and the plane was heading straight toward a hill. He put the B-29 into a steep 180-degree turn, hoping to land at the base. The plane began to stall, with a trailer park directly in its path. Steffes banked to the left, narrowly missing the mobile homes. The B-29 hit the ground, slid through a field, caught on fire, and broke into pieces. When it came to a stop, the crew struggled to get out, but the escape hatches were jammed. Sergeant Paul Ramoneda, a 28-year-old baker with the 9th Food Service Squadron, was one of the first to reach the bomber. He helped to pull Steffes from the cockpit. General Travis was found nearby, unconscious on the ground. Ambulances, fire trucks, and police cars soon arrived at the field, along with hundreds of enlisted men and civilians, many of them awakened by the crash, now eager to help out or just curious to see what was going on. The squadron commander, Roy Halsey, told everyone to get away from the plane and ordered the firefighters to let it burn. Flares and 50-caliber ammunition had begun to go off in the wreckage, and Halsey was afraid that the 5,000 pounds of high explosives in the atomic bomb would soon detonate. The crowd and the firefighters ignored him. Halsey, the highest-ranking officer on the scene, ran away as fast as he could. Sergeant Ramoneda wrapped his baker's apron around his head for protection from the flames and returned to the burning plane, searching for more survivors. Moments later, the high explosives in the Mark IV detonated. The blast could be heard 30 miles away. It killed Ramoneda and 5 firefighters, wounded almost 200 people, destroyed all of the base's fire trucks, set nearby buildings on fire, and scattered burning fuel and pieces of molten fuselage across an area of about 2 square miles. Captain Steffes and 7 others on the plane escaped with minor injuries. 12 crew members and passengers died, including General Travis, in whose honor the base was soon renamed. The Air Force told the press that the B-29 had been on a long training mission, without mentioning that an atomic bomb had caused the explosion. An accident could involve more than one weapon. On July 27, 1956, an American B-47 bomber took off from Lakenheath Air Base in Suffolk, England. It was, in fact, on a routine training flight. The plane did not carry a nuclear weapon. Captain Russell Bowling and his crew were scheduled to perform an aerial refueling, a series of touch-and-go landings, and a test of the B-47's radar system. The first 3 touch-and-go landings at Lakenheath went smoothly. The plane veered off the runway during the 4th and slammed into a storage igloo containing Mark VI atomic bombs. A SAC officer described the accident to LeMay in a classified telegram. The B-47 tore apart the igloo and knocked about 3 Mark VIs. Aircraft then exploded, showering burning fuel over all. Crew perished. Most of aircraft wreckage pivoted on igloo and came to rest with aircraft nose just beyond igloo bank, which kept main fuel fire outside smashed igloo. Preliminary exam by bomb disposal officer says a miracle that 1 Mark VI with exposed detonators sheared didn't go. Firefighters extinguished fire around Mark VIs fast. The cores were stored in a different igloo. If the B-47 had struck that igloo instead, tearing it open and igniting it. A cloud of plutonium could have floated across the English countryside. The engineers at Sandia knew that nuclear weapons could never be made perfectly safe. Oscar Morgenstern, an eminent Princeton economist, military strategist, and Pentagon advisor, noted the futility of seeking that goal. "Someday there will be an accidental explosion of a nuclear weapon," Morgenstern wrote. "The human mind cannot construct something that is infallible. The laws of probability virtually guarantee such an accident." Every nation that possessed nuclear weapons had to confront the inherent risk. "Maintaining a nuclear capability in some state of readiness is fundamentally a matter of playing percentages," a Sandia report acknowledged. "In order to reduce the danger, weapon designers and military officials wrestled with two difficult but interconnected questions. What was the acceptable probability of an accidental nuclear explosion? And what were the technical means to keep the odds as low as possible?" The Army's Office of Special Weapons Developments had addressed the first question in a 1955 report, "Acceptable Military Risks from Accidental Detonation of Atomic Weapons." It looked at the frequency of natural disasters in the United States during the previous 50 years, quantified their harmful effects according to property damage and loss of life, and then argued that accidental nuclear explosions should be permitted on American soil at the same rate as similarly devastating earthquakes, floods, and tornadoes. According to that formula, the Army suggested that the acceptable probability of a hydrogen bomb detonating within the United States should be 1 in 100,000 during the course of a year. The acceptable risk of an atomic bomb going off was set at 1 in 125. After Secretary of the Air Force Quarles expressed concern about the safety of sealed pit weapons, the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project began its own research on acceptable probabilities. The Army had assumed that the American people would regard a nuclear accident no differently from an act of God. An AFSWP study questioned the assumption, warning that the psychological impact of a nuclear detonation might well be disastrous, and that there will likely be a tendency to blame the irresponsible military and scientists. Moreover, the study pointed out that the safety of nuclear weapons already in the American stockpile had been measured solely by the risk of a technical malfunction. Human error had been excluded as a possible cause of accidents. It was thought too complex to quantify. The AFSWP study criticized that omission. "The unpredictable behavior of human beings is a grave problem when dealing with nuclear weapons." In 1957, the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project offered a new set of acceptable probabilities. For example, it proposed that the odds of a hydrogen bomb exploding accidentally from all causes while in storage during the entire life of the weapon should be 1 in 10 million. And the lifespan of a typical weapon was assumed to be 10 years. At first glance, those odds made the possibility of a nuclear disaster seem remote. But if the United States kept 10,000 hydrogen bombs in storage for 10 years, the odds of an accidental detonation became much higher, 1 in 1,000. And if those weapons were removed from storage and loaded onto airplanes, the AFSWP study proposed some acceptable probabilities that the American public, had it been informed, might not have found so acceptable. The odds of a hydrogen bomb detonating by accident every decade would be 1 in 5. And during that same period, the odds of an atomic bomb detonating by accident in the United States would be about 100%. All of those probabilities, acceptable or unacceptable, were merely design goals. They were based on educated guesses, not hard evidence, especially when human behavior was involved. The one-point safety of a nuclear weapon seemed like a more straightforward issue. It would be determined by phenomena that were quantifiable: the velocity of high explosives, the mass and geometry of a nuclear core, the number of fissions that could occur during an asymmetrical implosion. But even those things were haunted by mathematical uncertainty. The one-point safety tests at Nevada test site had provided encouraging results, and yet the behavior of a nuclear weapon in an abnormal environment, like that of a fuel fire ignited by a plane crash, was still poorly understood. During a fire, the high explosives of a weapon might burn, they might detonate, or they might burn and then detonate. And different weapons might respond differently to the same fire, based on the type, weight, and configuration of their high explosives. For firefighting purposes, each weapon was assigned a time factor, the amount of time you had once a weapon was engulfed in flames, either to put out the fire or to get at least 1,000 feet away from it. The time factor for the genie was 3 minutes. Even if a weapon could be made fully one-point safe, it might still detonate by accident. A glitch in the electrical system could potentially arm a bomb and trigger all its detonators. Carl Carlson, a young physicist at Sandia, came to believe that the design of a nuclear weapon's electrical system was the key to preventing accidental detonations. The heat of a fire might start the thermal batteries, release high-voltage electricity into the X unit, and then set off the bomb. To eliminate that risk, heat-sensitive fuses were added to every sealed pit weapon. At a temperature of 300 degrees Fahrenheit, the fuses would blow, melting the connections between the batteries and the arming system. It was a straightforward, time-honored way to interrupt an electrical circuit, and it promised to ensure that a high temperature wouldn't trigger the detonators. But Carlson was still worried that in other situations a firing signal could still be sent to a nuclear weapon, by accident or by mistake. A strong believer in systems analysis and the use of multiple disciplines to solve complex questions, Carlson thought that adding heat-sensitive fuses to nuclear weapons wasn't enough. The real safety problem was more easily stated than solved. Bombs were dumb. They responded to simple electrical inputs, and they had no means of knowing whether a signal had been sent deliberately. In the cockpit of a SAC bomber, the T-249 control box made it easy to arm a weapon. First, you flicked the toggle switch to on, allowing power to flow from the aircraft to the bomb. Then you turned a knob from the safe position either to ground or to air, setting the height at which the bomb would detonate. That was all it took. And if somebody forgot to return the knob to safe, the bomb would remain armed, even after the power switch was turned off. Writing on behalf of Sandia and the other weapon labs, Carlson warned that an overly simplistic electrical system increased the risk of a full-scale detonation during an accident. A weapon which requires only the receipt of intelligence from the delivery system for arming will accept and respond to such intelligence whether the signals are intentional or not. The need for a nuclear weapon to be safe and the need for it to be reliable were often in conflict. A safety mechanism that made a bomb less likely to explode during an accident could also, during wartime, render it more likely to be a dud. The contradiction between these two design goals was succinctly expressed by the words, always, never. Ideally, a nuclear weapon would always detonate when it was supposed to, and never detonate when it wasn't supposed to. The Strategic Air Command wanted bombs that were safe and reliable, but most of all, it wanted bombs that worked. A willingness to take personal risks was deeply embedded in SAC's institutional culture. Bomber crews risked their lives every time they flew a peacetime mission, and the emergency war plan missions for which they trained would be extremely dangerous. The crews would have to elude Soviet fighter planes and anti-aircraft missiles en route to their targets, survive the blast effects and radiation after dropping their bombs, and then somehow find a friendly airbase that hadn't been destroyed. They would not be pleased, amid the chaos of thermonuclear warfare, to learn that the bombs they dropped didn't detonate because of a safety device. Civilian weapon designers, on the other hand, were bound to have a different perspective. To think about the peacetime risk of an accident and err on the side of never. Secretary of the Air Force Quarles understood the arguments on both sides. He worried constantly about the Soviet threat. And he had pushed the Atomic Energy Commission to find methods of achieving a higher degree of nuclear safing. But if compromises had to be made between always and never, he made clear which side would have to bend. Such safing, Quarles instructed, should of course cause minimum interference with readiness and reliability. The optimum mix. A super long-distance intercontinental multi-stage ballistic rocket was launched a few days ago, the Soviet Union announced during the last week of August 1957. The news didn't come as a surprise to Pentagon officials, who'd secretly monitored the test flight with help from a radar station in Iran. But the announcement 6 weeks later that the Soviets had placed the first man-made satellite into orbit caught the United States off guard and created a sense of panic among the American people. Sputnik 1 was a metallic sphere about the size of a beach ball that could do little more than circle the Earth and transmit a radio signal of beep, beep. Nevertheless, it gave the Soviet Union a huge propaganda victory. It created the impression that the first socialist society had surpassed the United States in missile technology and scientific expertise. The successful launch of Sputnik 2 on November 3, 1957, seemed even more ominous. The new satellite weighed about half a ton. Rocket engines with enough thrust to lift that sort of payload could be used to deliver a nuclear warhead. Sputnik 2 also carried the first animal to orbit the Earth, a small dog named Laika, evidence that the Soviet Union was planning to put a man in space. Although the Soviets boasted that Laika lived for a week in orbit, wearing a little space suit, housed in a pressurized compartment with an ample supply of food and water, she actually died within a few hours of liftoff. Democrats in Congress whipped up fears of Soviet missiles and attacked the Eisenhower administration for allowing the United States to fall behind. The Democratic Advisory Council said that President Eisenhower had weakened the free world and starved the national defense. Henry Scoop Jackson, a Democratic senator from Washington, called Sputnik a devastating blow to U.S. prestige. Lyndon Baines Johnson, the Senate Majority Leader, scheduled hearings to investigate what had gone wrong with America's defense policies. Johnson's staff director, George Reedy, urged him to plunge heavily into the missile controversy, suggesting that it could blast the Republicans out of the water, unify the Democratic Party, and elect you president. Another Democratic senator, John F. Kennedy, later accused Eisenhower of putting fiscal security ahead of national security and made the existence of a missile gap one of the central issues in his presidential campaign. The Democratic effort to create anxiety about a missile gap was facilitated by Nikita Khrushchev, first secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. In a series of public comments over the next few years, Khrushchev belittled the American military and bragged about his nation's technological achievements. The United States does not have an intercontinental missile, otherwise it would also have easily launched a satellite of its own. Now we are capable of directing a rocket to any part of the Earth, and if need be, with a hydrogen warhead. It is not a mere figure of speech when we say we have organized serial production of intercontinental ballistic rockets. Let the people abroad know it, I am making no secret of this, that in 1 year 250 missiles with hydrogen warheads came off the assembly line in the factory we visited. The territory of our country is immense. We have the possibility of dispersing our rocket facilities, of camouflaging them well. 200 rockets are sufficient to destroy England, France, and Germany, and 300 rockets will destroy the United States. At the present time, the USSR has so many rockets that mass production has been curtailed, and only the newest models are under construction. Khrushchev had condemned Stalin's crimes in 1956, released political prisoners, gained a reputation as a reformer and proposed a ban on nuclear weapons in Central Europe. But he'd also ordered Soviet troops to invade Hungary and overthrow its government. More than 20,000 Hungarian citizens were killed by the Red Army, and hundreds more were later executed. The thought of Khrushchev in command of so many long-range missiles seemed chilling. President Eisenhower tried to calm the hysteria about Soviet missiles and address the criticism that his administration had become passive, timid, and out of touch. He felt confident that large increases in defense spending were unnecessary, and that the Strategic Air Command had more than enough nuclear weapons to deter the Soviet Union. He was particularly irritated by a secret report submitted to him during the first week of November. A high-level committee led by H. Rowan Gaither, a former president of the Ford Foundation, called for tens of billions of dollars to be spent on new missile programs and a nationwide system of fallout shelters. Eisenhower thought that the Gaither Committee had an exaggerated view of the Soviet threat. In a televised speech on November 7, 1957, Eisenhower stressed that there was no reason to panic. The military strength of the free world was much greater than that of the communists. It misses the whole point to say that we must now increase our expenditures on all kinds of military hardware and defense, he said, with frustration. The speech had little effect. On the morning of November 25th, Lyndon Johnson opened the Senate hearings by asserting that we have slipped dangerously behind the Soviet Union in some very important fields, and an influential newspaper columnist described the Gaither Report as just about the grimmest warning in American history. While working in the Oval Office that day, Eisenhower had a stroke and suddenly found himself unable to speak. A week and a half later, a Vanguard rocket carrying America's first man-made satellite was launched at Cape Canaveral, Florida, before hundreds of reporters and a live television audience. The Vanguard rose about 4 feet into the air, hesitated, fell back to the launch pad, and exploded. The Pentagon had good reason to be concerned about the Soviet Union's long-range missiles, regardless of the actual number. A Soviet bomber would approach the United States at about 500 miles per hour, and the warhead of a Soviet missile would come at about 16,000 miles per hour. With luck, a bomber might be shot down. But no technology yet existed to destroy a nuclear warhead mid-flight. And a missile attack would give the United States little time to prepare its response. Soviet bombers would take 8 or 9 hours to reach the most important American targets. Soviet missiles could hit them in 30 minutes or less. Early warning of a ballistic missile attack would be necessary to protect the nation's leadership and ensure that SAC's retaliatory force could get off the ground. That sort of warning, however, might never come. The Dewline radars had been designed to track enemy aircraft, not missiles, and the Pentagon had no means of detecting ICBMs once they'd been launched. After Sputnik, the Air Force gained swift approval to construct the Ballistic Missile Early Warning System, BMUs, three huge radars that would spot Soviet missiles heading toward the United States. One of the radars would be built at Thule Air Base, Greenland, another at Clear Air Force Base, Alaska, and the third in the North Yorkshire Moors, England. Until the BMUs was completed, however, the first sign of a Soviet missile attack would probably be mushroom clouds rising above SAC bases and American cities. Work immediately began on a bomb alarm system that would instantly let the president know when cities and air bases were being destroyed. Hundreds of small, innocuous-looking metal canisters were placed atop buildings and telegraph poles throughout the United States. Optical sensors inside the canisters, according to a classified account of the system, would detect the characteristic flash of a nuclear explosion, locate precise blast locations, and indicate the intensity and pattern of the attack. At SAC headquarters, green lights dotting a map of the United States would turn red to display each nuclear detonation. The amount of warning time that the bomb alarm system could provide was far from ideal, especially if the Soviets managed to synchronize their missile launches so that all the warheads landed at once. But it seemed better than nothing. General LeMay had been concerned for years about the threat that missiles could pose to the Strategic Air Command. In 1956, SAC had begun to test a plan that would keep some of its bombers constantly on alert and get them airborne half an hour after being warned of an attack. The logistics of such a ground alert were daunting. Crews would need to sleep near the runways and run for their planes the moment that a klaxon sounded. Bombers would be parked fully loaded with nuclear weapons and fuel. The planes were said to be cocked like the hammer of a pistol. Tankers for aerial refueling would be loaded as well and prepared for takeoff. By the fall of 1957, ground alerts had become routine at SAC bases in the United States, Great Britain, and Morocco. And the Strategic Air Command hoped that within a year, at least one-third of its bombers would always be parked beside runways, ready to get off the ground within 15 minutes. The successful launch of the two Sputniks created the possibility that, during a missile attack, SAC might not have 15 minutes to launch the ground alert planes. LeMay had recently been promoted to serve as the Vice Chief of Staff at the Air Force, and his replacement at SAC, General Thomas S. Power, pushed hard for approval of an even bolder tactic, the airborne alert. Power was widely considered, among fellow officers at SAC, to be a mean son of a bitch. Born in New York City and raised in Great Neck, Long Island, he dropped out of high school, worked in construction, returned to high school at the age of 20, earned a degree, and joined the Army Air Corps in 1928. He later flew the lead plane during the firebombing of Tokyo and served as vice commander at SAC. He often played the role of LeMay's hatchet man, firing people, enforcing discipline, and making sure that orders were carried out. The two men shared a strategic outlook, but had different management styles. LeMay expressed disapproval with a stony silence or a few carefully chosen words. Power yelled and swore at subordinates. The warmth behind LeMay's gruff exterior, the intense devotion to the well-being of his men, was harder to find in his successor. Even LeMay admitted that Power was a sadist, sort of an autocratic bastard, and yet he got things done. Kindness, sensitivity, and a genial disposition were not essential traits for a commander planning to win a nuclear war. The basic premise of SAC's airborne alert was hard to refute. Planes that were already in the air wouldn't be destroyed by missiles that hit bases on the ground. Keeping a portion of the bomber fleet airborne at all times would allow the United States to retaliate after a surprise attack. During an airborne alert, American bombers would take off and fly within striking distance of the Soviet Union. If the planes failed to receive a go code, they'd turn around at a prearranged spot, circle for hours, and then return to their bases. The plan erred on the side of safety. A breakdown in communications between SAC headquarters and one of the bombers would end its mission without any bombs being dropped. The mission would fail-safe, an engineering term for components designed to break without causing harm. The fail-safe measures of an airborne alert could reduce the effectiveness of SAC's nuclear retaliation once America was at war. Bombers that didn't receive a go code would circle and then return home, leaving their targets untouched. But the alternative, an airborne alert in which crews were ordered to fly to the Soviet Union and bomb it unless they received some sort of don't-go code from headquarters, could easily start a war by mistake. That sort of mission was bound, at some point, to fail deadly. "Day and night I have a certain percentage of my command in the air," General Power told the press the week after the second Sputnik launch. "These planes are bombed up and they don't carry bows and arrows." The message to the Soviet Union was unmistakable. SAC's ability to retaliate wouldn't be diminished by intercontinental ballistic missiles. But Power was bluffing. The airborne alert existed only on paper, and the United States didn't keep bombers in the air day and night, ready to strike. Carrying nuclear weapons over populated areas was still considered too dangerous. Designers at the weapons labs had been surprised to hear about SAC's ground alert. Aside from the occasional training exercise, the Atomic Energy Commission had always assumed that hydrogen bombs and atomic bombs would be safely locked away in igloos until the nation was at war. The idea of parking bombers near runways loaded with nuclear weapons and fuel had been proposed by LeMay, backed by the Joint Chiefs, and approved by President Eisenhower without input from Los Alamos or Sandia. An airborne alert would be much riskier. The safety questions about the new sealed pit weapons hadn't been resolved, and if older weapons were used during an airborne alert, their nuclear cores would have to be placed before takeoff into an in-flight insertion mechanism. It held the core about a foot outside the sphere of explosives while the plane was en route to the target, and then pushed the core all the way inside the sphere using a motor-driven screw when the bomb was about to be dropped. The contraption made the weapons safer to transport, but not much. Once the core was placed into this mechanism, according to a Sandia report, nuclear safety is not absolute. It is non-existent. The odds of a nuclear detonation during a crash or a fire would be about 1 in 7. Weapon safety became an ongoing point of contention between the Strategic Air Command and the Atomic Energy Commission. General Power not only wanted to start an airborne alert as soon as possible, he also wanted SAC's ground alert bombers to take off and land with fully assembled weapons during drills. When the AEC suggested that dummy weapons could be used instead, the Air Force came up with a series of arguments for why that would be operationally unsuitable. During an emergency, having dummy weapons on board would degrade the reaction time to an unacceptable degree, SAC's director of operations argued. They'd hurt crew morale and motivation, and they were hard to obtain. The typical airbase had only 7 dummy weapons, SAC claimed, a scarcity that made it necessary to train with real ones. Although the Atomic Energy Commission no longer retained physical possession of the hydrogen bombs stored at SAC bases, it still had legal custody. The AEC refused to allow any fully assembled bombs to be flown on SAC bombers. That prohibition applied to sealed pit weapons and to older weapons with their cores attached. Crews were permitted, however, to train with fully assembled bombs and to load them onto planes, so long as the planes never left the ground. SAC's arguments on behalf of an airborne alert were strengthened by the apparent shortcomings in the American missile program. A week before the launch of Sputnik 1, an Atlas long-range missile had failed spectacularly in the sky above Cape Canaveral, Florida. It was the second Atlas failure of the year. Near the end of the Second World War, the United States and the Soviet Union had fiercely competed to recruit Nazi rocket scientists. Although the 3 leading figures in Germany's V-2 program, Werner von Braun, Arthur Rudolph, and Walter Dornberger, were secretly brought to the United States and protected from war crimes trials, for almost a decade after the war, the Air Force showed little enthusiasm for long-range missiles. The V-2 had proven to be wildly inaccurate, more effective at inspiring terror in London than hitting specific targets. An intercontinental ballistic missile with the same accuracy as the V-2, fired at the Soviet Union from an American launch pad, was likely to miss its target by about 100 miles. Curtis LeMay thought bombers were more reliable than missiles, more versatile and precise. He wanted SAC to develop nuclear-powered bombers, capable of remaining airborne for weeks. But as thermonuclear weapons became small enough and light enough to be mounted atop a missile, accuracy became less of an issue. An H-bomb could miss a target by a wide margin and still destroy it. Even LeMay admitted that an accurate intercontinental ballistic missile would be the ultimate weapon. During the fall of 1957, the United States had 6 different strategic missiles in development, with rival bureaucracies fighting not only for money, but also for a prominent role in the emergency war plan. On behalf of the Army, Wernher von Braun's team was developing an intermediate-range missile, the Jupiter, that could travel 1,500 miles and hit Soviet targets from bases in Europe. The Air Force was working on an almost identical intermediate-range missile, the Thor, as well as three long-range missiles, Atlas, Titan, and Minuteman. The Navy was pursuing its own intermediate-range missile, the Polaris, having decided not to deploy the Army's Jupiter in submarines. The inter-service rivalry over missiles was exacerbated by the competition among the defense contractors hoping to build them. The General Dynamics Corporation lobbied aggressively for Atlas, the Martin Company for Titan, Boeing for Minuteman, Douglas Aircraft for Thor, Chrysler for Jupiter, and Lockheed for Polaris. President Eisenhower planned to fund two or three of these missile programs and canceled the rest, based on their merits and the nation's strategic needs. Amid Democratic accusations of a missile gap, Eisenhower agreed to fund all six. The Sputnik launches also complicated America's relationship with its NATO allies. The Soviet Union appeared to have gained a technological advantage, and the United States no longer seemed invincible. NATO ministers began to wonder if an American president really would defend Berlin or Paris, when that could mean warheads landing in New York City within an hour. Khrushchev's boasts about long-range missiles were accompanied by a Soviet peace campaign that called for nuclear disarmament and an end to nuclear weapon tests. For years, the World Peace Council, backed by the Soviet Union and Communist China, had been promoting efforts to ban the bomb. The slogan had a strong resonance in Great Britain, Germany, the Netherlands, and France, countries that felt trapped in the middle of an arms race between the superpowers, that had already endured two world wars and now rebelled against preparations for a third. While public opinion in Western Europe increasingly turned against nuclear weapons, the leadership of NATO sought an even greater reliance on them. The French, in particular, had long argued that the United States should cede control of its nuclear weapons based in Europe. Giving the weapons to NATO would allow the alliance to use them quickly in an emergency and prevent an American president from withholding them, regardless of any last-minute doubts. It would demonstrate that the fate of Europe and the United States were inextricably linked. In December 1957, President Eisenhower traveled to a NATO summit in Paris, only weeks after his stroke, and announced that the United States would provide its European allies with access to nuclear weapons. He offered to create a separate nuclear stockpile for NATO and build intermediate-range missile sites in NATO countries. The offer stopped short of actually handing over missiles and bombs. The Atomic Energy Act prohibited the transfer of nuclear weapons to a foreign power. Custody of the NATO stockpile would have to remain with the United States. The Eisenhower administration tried to strike a balance between physical control and legal custody, between sharing the weapons with allies in a meaningful way and obeying the will of Congress. As plans emerged to put intermediate-range missiles in Great Britain, Italy, and Turkey, to store atom bombs and hydrogen bombs and atomic artillery shells at NATO bases throughout Europe, the tricky issue of command and control was resolved with a technical solution. The launch controls of the missiles and the locks on the weapon igloos would require at least two keys, and an American officer would keep one of them. The Mark 36 was a second-generation hydrogen bomb. It weighed about half as much as the early thermonuclears, but 10 times more than the new sealed pit bombs that would soon be mass-produced for SAC. It was a transitional weapon, mixing old technologies with new, featuring thermal batteries, a removable core, and a contact fuse for use against underground targets. The nose of the bomb contained piezoelectric crystals, and when the nose hit the ground, the crystals deformed, sending a signal to the X unit, firing the detonators, and digging a very deep hole. The bomb had a yield of about 10 megatons. It was one of America's most powerful weapons. A B-47 bomber was taxiing down the runway at a SAC base in Sidi Sliman, Morocco, on January 31, 1958. The plane was on ground alert, practicing runway maneuvers, cocked but forbidden to take off. It carried a single Mark 36 bomb. To make the drill feel as realistic as possible, a nuclear core had been placed in the bomb's in-flight insertion mechanism. When the B-47 reached a speed of about 20 miles an hour, one of the rear tires blew out. A fire started in the wheel well and quickly spread to the fuselage. The crew escaped without injury, but the plane split in two, completely engulfed in flames. Firefighters sprayed the burning wreckage for 10 minutes, long past the time factor of the Mark 36, then withdrew. The flames reached the bomb, and the commanding general at Sidi Sliman ordered that the base be evacuated immediately. Cars full of airmen and their families sped into the Moroccan desert, fearing a nuclear disaster. The fire lasted for 2.5 hours. The high explosives in the Mark 36 burned, but didn't detonate. According to an accident report, the hydrogen bomb and parts of the B-47 bomber melted into a slab of slag material weighing approximately 8,000 pounds, approximately 6 to 8 feet wide and 12 to 15 feet in length, with a thickness of 10 to 12 inches. A jackhammer was used to break the slag into smaller pieces. The particularly hot pieces were sealed in cans, and the rest of the radioactive slag was buried next to the runway. Sidi Sliman lacked the proper equipment to measure levels of contamination, and a number of airmen got plutonium dust on their shoes, spreading it not just to their car, but also to another airbase. The Air Force planned to issue a press release about the accident, stressing that the aircraft fire hadn't led to explosion of the weapon, radiation, or other unexpected results. The State Department thought that was a bad idea. Details about the accident hadn't reached Europe or the United States. The less said about the Moroccan incident, the better, one State Department official argued at a meeting on how much information to disclose. A public statement might be distorted by Soviet propaganda and create needless anxiety in Europe. The Department of Defense agreed to keep the accident secret, although the King of Morocco was informed. When an American diplomat based in Paris asked for information about what had happened at Sidi Sliman, the State Department told him that the base commander had decided to stage a practice evacuation. 2 weeks after an accident that could have detonated a hydrogen bomb in Morocco, the Department of Defense and the Atomic Energy Commission issued a joint statement on weapon safety. In reply to inquiries about hazards which may be involved in the movement of nuclear weapons, they said, "It can be stated with assurance that the possibility of an accidental nuclear explosion is so remote as to be negligible." Less than a month later, Walter Gregg and his son Walter Jr. were in the tool shed outside their home in Mars Bluff, South Carolina, when a Mark 6 atomic bomb landed in the yard. Mrs. Gregg was inside the house sewing, and her daughters, Helen and Frances, aged 6 and 9, were playing outdoors with a 9-year-old cousin. The Mark 6 had a variable yield of anywhere from 8 to 160 kilotons. Depending on the type of nuclear core that was used. The bomb that landed in the yard didn't contain a core, but the high explosives went off when the weapon hit the ground, digging a crater about 50 feet wide and 35 feet deep. The blast wave and flying debris knocked the doors off the Gregg house, blew out the windows, collapsed the roof, riddled the walls with holes, destroyed the new Chevrolet parked in the driveway, killed half a dozen chickens, and sent the family to the hospital with minor injuries. The atom bomb had been dropped by a B-47 en route from Hunter Air Force Base near Savannah, Georgia, to Bruntingthorpe Air Base in Leicestershire, England. The locking pin had been removed from the bomb before takeoff, a standard operating procedure at SAC. Nuclear weapons were always unlocked from their bomb racks during takeoff and landing, in case the weapons had to be jettisoned during an emergency. But for the rest of the flight, they were locked to the racks. Bombs were locked and unlocked remotely on the B-47, using a small lever in the cockpit. The lever was attached by a lanyard to the locking pin on the bomb. As the B-47 above South Carolina climbed to an altitude of about 15,000 feet, a light on the instrument panel said that the pin hadn't re-engaged. The lever didn't seem to be working. The pilot told the navigator, Captain Bruce Kulka, to enter the bomb bay and insert the locking pin by hand. Kulka couldn't have been thrilled with the idea. The bomb bay wasn't pressurized. The door leading to it was too small for him to enter wearing a parachute, and he didn't know where the locking pin was located, let alone how to reinsert it. Kulka spent about 10 minutes in the bomb bay looking for the pin without success. It must be somewhere above the bomb, he thought. The Mark VI was a large weapon, about 11 feet long and 5 feet in diameter, and as Kulka tried to peek above it, he inadvertently grabbed the manual bomb release for support. The Mark VI suddenly dropped onto the bomb bay doors, and Kulka fell on top of it. A moment later, the 8,000-pound bomb broke through the doors. Kulka slid off it, got hold of something in the open bomb bay, and held on tight. Amid the gust and roar of the wind, about 3 miles above the small farms and cotton fields of Mars Bluff, he managed to pull himself back into the plane. Neither the pilot nor the co-pilot realized the bomb was gone until it hit the ground and exploded. The accident at Mars Bluff was impossible to hide from the press. Although Walter Gregg and his family had no idea what destroyed their home, the pilot of the B-47, unable to communicate with Hunter Air Force Base, told controllers at a nearby civilian airport that the plane had just lost a device. News of the explosion quickly spread. The state police formed checkpoints to keep people away from the Gregg property, and an Air Force decontamination team arrived to search for remnants of the Mark VI. Unlike the accident at Sidi Sliman, this one couldn't have produced a nuclear yield, and yet it gained worldwide attention and inspired a good deal of fear. Are we safe from our own atomic bombs? The New York Times asked. Is Carolina on your mind? Echoed London's Daily Mail. The Soviet Union claimed that a nuclear detonation had been prevented by sheer luck and that South Carolina had been contaminated by radioactive fallout. The Strategic Air Command tried to counter the Soviet propaganda with the truth. There'd never been a risk of nuclear detonation, nor of harmful radioactivity. But SAC also misled reporters. During a segment entitled Dead A-Bomb Hits U.S. Town, Ed Herlihy, the narrator of a popular American newsreel, repeated the official line, telling nervous movie audiences that this was the first accident of its kind in history. In fact, a hydrogen bomb had been mistakenly released over Albuquerque the previous year. Knocked off balance by air turbulence while standing in the bomb bay of a B-36, the plane's navigator had steadied himself by grabbing the nearest handle, the manual bomb release. The weapon broke through the bomb doors, and the navigator held onto the handle for dear life. The H-bomb landed in an unpopulated area about one-third of a mile from Sandia. The high explosives detonated, but did not produce a nuclear yield. The weapon lacked a core. The Air Force grounded all its bombers after the accident at Mars Bluff and announced a new policy. The locking pins wouldn't be removed from nuclear weapons during peacetime flights. But the announcement failed to dampen a growing anti-nuclear movement in Great Britain. General Power had inflamed public opinion by telling a British journalist who'd asked whether American aircraft routinely flew with nuclear weapons above England, "Well, we did not build these bombers to carry crushed rose petals." Members of the opposition Labour Party criticized Prime Minister Harold Macmillan for allowing such flights and demanded an end to them. Macmillan was in a difficult position. For security reasons, SAC wouldn't allow him to reveal that the bombs lacked cores, and wouldn't even let him know when American planes were carrying nuclear weapons in British airspace. Within weeks of the accident at Mars Bluff, a newly formed organization, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, CND, led thousands of people on a protest march from London's Trafalgar Square to the British nuclear weapon factory at Aldermaston. The CND rejected the whole concept of nuclear deterrence and argued that nuclear weapons were morally wrong. In preparation for the four-day march, the artist Gerald Holtham designed a symbol for the anti-nuclear movement. "I drew myself," Holtham recalled, "the representative of an individual in despair, with hands palm outstretched outwards and downwards in the manner of Goya's peasant before the firing squad." He placed a circle around the self-portrait, an elongated stick figure, and created an image later known as the peace sign. The Soviet Union worked hard to focus attention on the dangers of SAC's airborne alert and the possibility of an accidental nuclear war. Imagine that one of the airmen may, even without any evil intent, but through nervous mental derangement or an incorrectly understood order, drop his deadly load on the territory of some country, Khrushchev said during a speech. Then, according to the logic of war, an immediate counterblow will follow. Arkady A. Sobolev, the Soviet representative to the United Nations, made a similar argument before the Security Council, warning that the world has yet to see a foolproof system and that flights of American bombers bring a grave danger of atomic war. The Soviet concerns may have been sincere, but they also promoted the idea that American bombers were the greatest threat to world peace, not the hundreds of Soviet medium-range missiles aimed at the capitals of Western Europe. Bertrand Russell, among others, had changed his view about whom to blame. Having once called for the United States to launch a preventive war on the Soviet Union with atomic bombs, Russell now argued that the American air bases in England should be shut down and that Great Britain should unilaterally get rid of its nuclear weapons. The mental instability of SAC officers became a recurrent theme in Soviet propaganda. According to a Pentagon report obtained by an East German newspaper and discussed at length on Radio Moscow, 67.3% of the flight personnel in the United States Air Force were psychoneurotic. The report was a communist forgery. But its bureaucratic tone, its account of widespread alcoholism, sexual perversion, opium addiction, and marijuana use at SAC seemed convincing to many Europeans worried about American nuclear strategy. And the notion that a madman could deliberately start a world war became plausible not long after the forgery appeared, when an American mechanic stole a B-45 bomber from Alconbury Air Force Base in England and took it for a joyride. The mechanic, who'd never received flight training, crashed the jet not long after takeoff and died. A former Royal Air Force officer, Peter George, captured the new zeitgeist about nuclear weapons, the widespread fear of an accidental war, in a novel published amid the debate over SAC's airborne alert. Pulp fiction like One of Our H-Bombs Is Missing had already addressed some of these themes. But more than 250,000 copies of George's novel Red Alert were sold in the United States, and it subsequently inspired a classic Hollywood film. Written under the pseudonym Peter Bryant, George described how a deranged American general could single-handedly launch a nuclear attack. The madman's views were similar to those expressed by Bertrand Russell a decade earlier. The United States must destroy the Soviet Union before it can destroy the West. A few will suffer, the general believes, but millions will live. Once the scheme is uncovered, the general's airbase is assaulted by the U.S. Army. The President of the United States tries without success to recall SAC's bombers, and the Soviets question whether the impending attack really was a mistake. As an act of good faith, SAC discloses the flight paths of its B-52s so that they can be shot down. After negotiations between the leaders of the two nations and revelations about the ultimate deterrent, doomsday weapons capable of eliminating life on Earth to be triggered if the Soviets are facing defeat, all but one of the SAC bombers are shot down or recalled. and so a deal is struck. If the plane destroys a Soviet city, the president will select an American city for the Soviets to destroy in retaliation. The president chooses Atlantic City, New Jersey. The lone B-52 drops its hydrogen bomb over the Soviet Union, but the weapon misfires and misses its target. Although Atlantic City is saved and doomsday averted, Red Alert marked an important cultural shift. The Strategic Air Command would increasingly be portrayed as a refuge for lunatics and warmongers, not as the kind of place where you'd find Jimmy Stewart. General Power was unfazed by protest marches in Great Britain, apocalyptic fears, criticism in the press, freak accidents, strong opposition at the AEC, Eisenhower's reluctance, and even doubts about the idea expressed by LeMay. Power wanted an airborne alert. The decision to authorize one would be made by President Eisenhower. The phrase "failsafe" had been removed from Air Force descriptions of the plan. The word "fail" had the wrong connotations, and the new term didn't sound so negative. Positive control. With strong backing from members of Congress, SAC proposed a test of the airborne alert. B-52s would take off from bases throughout America carrying sealed pit weapons. At a White House briefing in July 1958, Eisenhower was told that the probability of any nuclear detonation during a crash is essentially zero. The following month, he gave tentative approval for the test. But the new chairman of the AEC, John A. McCone, wanted to limit its scale. McCone thought that the bombers should be permitted to use only Loring Air Force Base in Maine, so that an accident or the jettison of a weapon would be likely to occur over the Atlantic Ocean, not the United States. During the first week of October, President Eisenhower authorized SAC to take off and land at Loring with fully assembled hydrogen bombs. The flights secretly began, and SAC's airborne alert was no longer a bluff. Fred Eakley completed his RAND report on the risk of an accidental or unauthorized nuclear detonation 2 weeks after Eisenhower's decision. Eakley's top-secret clearance had gained him access to the latest safety studies by Sandia, the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, and the Air Force Special Weapons Center. He'd read accident reports, met with bomb designers at Sandia, immersed himself in the technical literature on nuclear weapons. He'd discussed the logistical details of SAC's airborne alert, not only with the officers who would command them, but also with the RAND analysts who'd come up with the idea in 1956. Eakley's report was the first thorough, wide-ranging, independent analysis of nuclear weapons safety in the United States, and it did not confirm the optimistic assurances that President Eisenhower had just been given. We cannot derive much confidence from the fact that no unauthorized detonation has occurred to date, Eakley warned. The past safety record means nothing for the future. The design of nuclear weapons had a learning curve, and he feared that some knowledge might come at a high price. Technical flaws and malfunctions could be eliminated readily once they are discovered, but it takes a great deal of ingenuity and intuition to prevent them beforehand. The risk wasn't negligible, as the Department of Defense and the Air Force claimed. The risk was impossible to determine, and accidents were likely to become more frequent in the future. During Air Force training exercises in 1957, an atomic bomb or a hydrogen bomb had been inadvertently jettisoned once every 320 flights, and B-52 bombers seemed to crash at a rate of about once every 20,000 flying hours. According to Eakley's calculations, that meant SAC's airborne alert would lead to roughly 12 crashes with nuclear weapons and 7 bomb jettisons every year. The paramount task, he argued, is to learn enough from minor incidents to prevent a catastrophic disaster. Even more worrisome than the technical challenges were the risks of human error and sabotage. Eakley noted that the Air Force's shortage of trained weapon handlers sometimes makes it necessary to entrust unspecialized personnel with complex tasks on nuclear weapons. A single mistake, or more likely a series of mistakes, could cause a nuclear detonation. Safety measures like checklists, seals that must be broken before knobs can be turned, and constant training might reduce the odds of human error. But Iklay thought that none of those things could protect against a threat that seemed like the stuff of pulp fiction. Deliberate, unauthorized attempts to detonate a nuclear weapon. The technical safeguards currently in use could be circumvented by someone who knew the workings of the fusing and firing mechanism. On at least one occasion, a drunken enlisted man had overpowered a guard at a nuclear storage site and attempted to gain access to the bombs. It can hardly be denied that there is a risk of unauthorized acts, Iklay wrote, and figuring out how to stop them remained one of the most baffling problems of nuclear weapon safety. With help from the psychiatrist Gerald J. Aronson, Iklay outlined some of the motivations that could prompt someone to disobey orders and set off a nuclear weapon. The risk wasn't hypothetical. About 20,000 Air Force personnel worked with nuclear weapons, and in order to do so, they had to obtain a secret or a top-secret clearance. But they didn't have to undergo any psychiatric screening. In fact, a history of transient psychotic disorders no longer disqualified a recruit from joining the Air Force. A few hundred Air Force officers and enlisted men were annually removed from duty because of their psychotic disorders, and perhaps 10 or 20 who worked with nuclear weapons could be expected to have a severe mental breakdown every year. In an appendix to the report, Aronson offered a catalog of derangement that seemed relevant to nuclear safety. The most dangerous disorders involved paranoia. Aronson provided a case history of the type of officer who needed to be kept away from atomic bombs. A 23-year-old pilot, a lieutenant, had difficulty in maintaining social contacts, fearful of disapproval and anxious to please. A few hours after he had to say sir to someone, he was overwhelmed with fantasies of tearing that person apart. He felt like exploding when in crowded restaurants. This feeling lessened when hostile fantasies of tearing the place apart